Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, where our job is to help you build visibility, professional credibility, and connection with your ideal client by putting the human at the center of innovative marketing, so you can build and strengthen an engaging, enduring relationship with your ideal clients. I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm honored that you're here with me. If you haven't joined our wonderful marketing transformation community yet, go to innovabiz.co and collect your free gift as well. Do subscribe to the show and also leave a review because it helps others find us. Let's get into today's masterclass on this InnovaBuzz podcast.
Everyone needs to rethink what their innovation process looks like. It needs to be more of a methodology than a process, number one. And to me, the difference between a process and a methodology is a methodology has a process plus an approach that's very much centered on learning. And so if you create an innovation process centered around a learning framework that's designed really to seek product market fit for an idea before that idea is fully formed and all the capital and resources are invested in building it as if it's already successful, and work your way back to the lab from there, you can reduce the time and cost to launch any innovation and improve the success rate.
Welcome back. I hope you've had an awesome week so far. If you haven't yet listened to my recent conversations with Dr. Bruno Signaco of Human Oriented Enterprise and Dave McEwen, author of The Self-Evolved Leader, then do check them out after you've listened to today's conversation. I'm really excited to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast as my guest today, Sean Shepherd. He's the founding partner of GrowthX. In addition to helping dozens of startups find product market fit and predicted revenue models, Sean helps global multinationals to identify new applications for their existing technology portfolio, bring new products to market with profitable business models, and organize and train self-managing early product stage sales and marketing teams. Sean was named as one of the top sales influencers you should be following on social media. He's an active mentor, advisor, and guest lecturer at global startup accelerators, innovation conferences, and colleges and universities. He's now committed to working with countries, companies, entrepreneurs, and those who want to work with them on building startup ecosystems and developing the next generation of leaders for the innovation economy. In our discussion today, Sean talked to me about the biggest problem innovative products have, and that's product to market fit. He explained how to embed a learning framework in your organization, and he outlined the skills necessary to thrive in the knowledge economy. Without further ado then, let's fly into the hive and get the buzz from Sean Shepherd. Hi, I'm your host, Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz, and I'm really excited to welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast today, all the way from San Francisco in California, the USA, of course, Sean Shepherd, who's the founding partner of GrowthX. He's a globally recognized sales and marketing thought leader with over 20 years of experience bringing new products to market, including as a five-time sales founder. Welcome to the InnovaBuzz podcast, Sean. It's a real privilege to have you as my guest.
Thanks, Jürgen. I'm thrilled to be here.
Now, you work with clients in building startup ecosystems and developing the next generations of leaders for the innovation economy. And you also work on disruptive innovations and how companies can position themselves to build those or take advantage of them or to be aware of what's happening. So I'm really keen to explore all that today. But before we do, give us a whistle-stop tour of how you got to where you are today and some of the pivotal moments on that journey.
Sure. You know, I after college, I played golf for a little while professionally and gave it a go, and felt like, well, I got a little burned out on that. So I decided to move into the tech business. I grew up in Silicon Valley and in the tech field, and was always very excited about the promise of technology and what it can do to help the world be a better place. And although I'm not a technologist myself, I like to make the joke, I can't even spell HTML. I know how businesses can solve problems using technology. I'm pretty good at translating that. So I had probably my first and only job in enterprise sales after leaving golf, and was pretty successful at that. Learned a lot, and was lured away to be the first sales leader in a startup. I learned and kind of cut my teeth on how it's different to be that first person taking a product to market. And then I parlayed that exit into co-founding several other enterprise technology startups over the years. I've had three exits. I've had a lot of very valuable learning experiences, as well as some, that's what I would call a failure, is a valuable learning experience along the way. And about 7 years ago, I moved from the entrepreneurial side to the investment side, launched a seed stage venture capital fund with some partners here, and quickly realized that the biggest problem our startups were facing was not product development, but market development. And then I learned through the course of my own research, along with my intuition, the research confirmed that most startups fail and most new product launches fail, not because of products and technology, but because of markets and people. And so I set out to try and solve that problem for our own investments by building a market acceleration program, a framework for helping companies find product market fit. It was very successful in our own portfolio, and word got out, and we started to license it to other funds, accelerators, incubators, universities, governments, and even corporations that said, look, we have the same challenge, commercializing new innovations. And that slowly evolved into helping a whole host of different kinds of organizations with the concept of finding product market fit. It's really designed to do three things. Find the truth about where a product fits in the market, if it does at all, and what to do about it. Create a functional learning organization out of the team of people who are responsible for doing that, because it's very much a stage relevant skill set that's required to be efficient and successful at finding product market fit. And then ultimately, the third thing is to find a profitable business model through the course of that. And if you can do those three things, you can build sustainable, lasting products in the market. And for corporations, it's all about protecting and growing revenue and market share by responding to the current needs of the market, especially in the age of COVID. For startups, it's all about staying on the field long enough to learn and build something sustainable that gives you a reason to go out and raise more money or acquire more resources so that you can scale. For governments and accelerators and investors, it's all about aligning incentives and creating a model where you can invest in companies, help them grow, and develop the talent that is required to support that system. And so these days, I spend most of my time running around the world talking about these things, or at least I did before COVID, and supporting our businesses and helping those various constituencies.
Mm. Yeah, that's a pretty powerful why. So you invested in companies and saw a gap that where they were not being successful and addressed that gap.
Yeah, I see. And it's a pretty common trait you see among successful entrepreneurs. They typically go about solving their own problem in a novel way and then find out that other people have that same problem and then are able to share that with the world. I always say that in today's age of applied innovation, where it's never been easier or cheaper to get products launched, it's also never been more difficult to get traction for those products in the market. So you need an approach that is very much focused on finding product market fit before you invest too much inside your building, building to your own vision as opposed to the problems that the customers face.
Hmm. So one of the things I know you're very focused on, and you mentioned this here, that you know there's the product market fit, but there's also the people part of that. And I know you're very strong on the relationship side. So in terms of getting started and getting that early traction in a really noisy marketplace, how does the people part fit into that? And what are your recommendations to kind of get started with the relationship side of things?
Yeah, well, I think there's two kinds of, I think there's two ways to answer that question. There's the talent required to take a product to market. And then there is the people that you have to build relationships with in the market to get the two things you need the most from them at this stage, which are their time and their truth. I always say it's not about selling products to customers when you're going to market. It's about recruiting partners that share your vision, understand your current reality, and are willing to invest their time and truth in the journey to get from your current reality to that vision. And that's not just people who meet a certain criteria of industry or sector or department or role or title, or might have a problem that you think you can solve for, but they also have to have that mindset, that innovative or early adopter mindset that Geoffrey Moore talks about in his book, Crossing the Chasm, which is something that's been very much a part of what's guided my philosophy and approach over the last decade or so. Is it's one thing to identify a customer profile with a particular problem that you can solve, but it's another thing to find the people, the individuals inside of that company that are willing to take the risk early on working with you. And so that's sort of what you need to find within the market that you're going after. In terms of the people on your side that you need to trust with the process of driving that for you, I call that a stage relevant skill set. They need to have, it's more their characteristics and traits and what's sort of innate in their DNA that's important than their background or experience or existing relationships in a market. I mean, those things are important, but they'll only get you so far. You need people that can embrace ambiguity, that can communicate well across functional areas of a customer as well as inside your organization. You know, they need to understand what the customer wants and then translate that back to product people who aren't always great at talking to humans or very good per se at leading the learning process and driving, taking, you know, an organization or a product through that learning curve. They have to love technology, but they don't necessarily need to be a technologist. And I think most importantly, they have to have a learn-it-all mindset instead of a know-it-all mindset to drive that learning and recognize how to accelerate it and focus on a very small cohort of opportunities that meet that profile that I laid out to get where they want to go so that they can get to referenceability as quickly as possible and then cross that chasm that Geoffrey Moore talks about from early adopters into the mainstream marketplace, which represents the majority of the market. But the thing with the mainstream is they are pretty risk averse. They try, you know, they typically only want to buy from market leaders. They want referenceability from other mainstream peers that are also just as risk averse. And that's where a lot of the challenges exist. So the strategy needs to be to accelerate your path through the learning curve with innovators and early adopters to the point to where you can assume a position of market leadership or superiority with that particular use case in a way that shows the mainstream that you have credibility.
Hmm. Yeah, I recall, I mean, this is the second attempt we've had at this recording. The first time we had lots of technical issues, but we did get a long way into the conversation. And I remember you telling me about Crossing the Chasm and Geoffrey Moore's model. I haven't yet read the book, but I will be adding that to my reading list. It's interesting you talked there, and this is from his model. I think the three types of people and the early adopters, the mainstream, and then the laggards. Is that the right
thing? Yeah, he identifies five communities. And really, his book comes out of some research that was done on human behavior in an agricultural study in the 1950s. And he applied it to technology in that there are five kinds of people in the world when it comes to how they respond to risk and change. And they are innovators, early adopters, the majority, and skeptics and laggards. And I think skeptics and laggards are fairly self-explanatory. You know, those are the folks that are still running around with flip phones and aren't necessarily very, you know, attuned to taking any sorts of risks. They represent about 20% of the market. The mainstream represents the bulk of the market, about 60%, you know, it's your typical distribution curve. And then the other 15 to 20% is on the front end between split between innovators and early adopters. Innovators are great for early product feedback. They will help you build something that's functional and useful. They love the bright, not shiny new objects, but they typically don't have budget or staying power. They'll typically either not be allowed to have budget because they are so risky, but they will. And then in addition to that, they typically will move on and be easily distracted by other projects and other bright, shiny objects. But they're very useful in the early stages of product development. And then really, though, the ones that are going to carry you forward to help you find your business model, again, talking about the three things that we're trying to do, right? Find product market fit, create a functional learning organization, and create a business model that's lasting, are your early adopters. These people have they're willing to take calculated risks for strategic reasons, and they typically have budget, and their vision, if it's aligned with yours, is one that sees exponential return on working with you early, usually to create some sort of a competitive advantage or transformational change. And the key is that as you're out there trying to recruit early partners to work with, is you need to look for the signals and the flags that pop up that tell you whether or not these folks are mainstream, skeptic, laggard, innovative, or early adopters. And it will come through in how they react and respond to what your propositions are. And they'll ask questions that are that will lead you to believe that they are either very innovative, they're definitely early adopters, or they're not. And if they're not, that's okay. You just sort of need to back away from those folks, not pursue them, and find the ones that are willing to take those risks.
Hmm. Yeah, it's an interesting model. It reminds me a little bit of, you know, the idea of customer journeys in marketing, where you look at everybody coming into a rather complex network of customer journeys, and Google's done a lot of published a lot of interesting discussion papers on this recently about how complex customer journeys are these days. And mm-hmm. and so people come in at different parts of that network, if you like, of customer journeys. And as a good marketer, you treat people coming into different parts of the customer journeys differently. You meet them where they are and you nurture them appropriately. So in a way, do you see it being the same?
I believe you end up at that place. What I would say is that's after typically you found out where you fit. That's much more what I would call, you know, optimization, standardization. So another thing Jeffrey talks about is the kind of the three steps of developing a business, and you have creation, standardization, and optimization. And I'm very much focused on the creation and standardization phases, because that's where the majority of the failure is.
Yeah.
And so when Google talks about optimizing the customer journey, that's exactly what it is. Mapping the journey. Now you can do very simple things very early on in the creation and standardization phase to try and optimize the journey. But my philosophy and my experience there would suggest that you got to keep it as simple as you possibly can. Yes, you go where they are, you meet them where they are, you build what they want, you create the data and the insights that drive their behaviors and help you establish a relationship, and you go very deep with very few customers early. So customer journey mapping, customer experience, user experience, pre-sale, onboarding, implementation, and post-sale are very important, and you have to pay a ton of attention to them, but you want to keep those things as simple as possible.
Hmm.
the number one barrier to change is barriers. It's not what a lot of us have always kind of thought it is, which is, okay, people just don't get it. We need to give them more facts and data. No, in fact, what we have to do is remove all the barriers to change. Make it as easy as possible for people to change their behavior, even if it's just incremental, to get them to change. Because our number one competitor, I always tell my startups, is not some other vendor. It's changing the way people are doing things. It's behavioral change. And so you have to be very mindful of that. And so you have to create a situation whereby it makes it easy for people to change. The other thing I always say is people don't want more work, they want less. So when you're presenting them with new propositions and behavioral change, you need to show them how it's less work and how it's easy for them to make that change.
Well, I think we can all probably think of many examples where things have been made difficult, where we've been expected to do something. And you know, in this COVID world, there's lots of behavioral change expected of all of us. Things have been made a lot more difficult than they could be. And it gets quite frustrating as the person expected to make that change. So do you have any really good examples of someone who's done this well, or a situation that this has been done really well, where people have been required to make a change, or there's been a change involved in adopting a new process or a new product, and it's been done really well?
Well, yeah. I mean, first I would say that we all have a tremendous innate capacity to change. And COVID is demonstrating that right now. I mean, look how quickly major manufacturers are flipping from making alcohol to sanitizers, or from manufacturing industrial equipment to PPE or ventilators. There's only two ways people change: because they want to or because they have to. And COVID is showing us what happens when people have to make that change. Those of us that are willing to embrace it are responding accordingly, and I think reaping the rewards, and those that aren't are probably struggling. And I would say that those are examples. One of the things that Jeffrey talks about, and it's funny, we're really talking a lot about him, is the notion of a continuous innovation versus a discontinuous innovation and how they're unique and different. So for example, the newest iPhone is a continuous innovation, but the original iPhone was a discontinuous one because of the amount of change that we were asking people to make. And there's a whole host of different factors that go into when and why and how those things are successful. I'll point to Bill Gross at Idea Labs, who is probably one of the most prolific and successful Silicon Valley investors and entrepreneurs in history, who's had a ton of unicorns come out of his incubators. And he did an analysis, and you could Google this and watch his talk, but he did an analysis on the number one factor for his success, and it was timing, not anything else, just bringing something to market at the right time when the market was ready for that kind of change. Now, you can't predict that, certainly. There are many factors in emerging trends, whether they're macro or micro, that you can look at to try and determine what those things are. But ultimately, people are either going to do it, you know, on their own, or they're going to do it because they're forced into it. But I believe the capacity for change is there for everyone. But now the standard user experience is set by the Amazons and the Apples of the world. I like to say Amazon, right? The number one, the most valuable company in the world. They don't make anything except all of us happy and satisfied. Right. We know the old axiom of one of the largest car companies is Uber, and they own almost no vehicles.
That's right.
Hotelier is Airbnb. They don't own a single room. You know, Facebook is the largest advertiser and doesn't own a single billboard. So, you know, it's a different world now. And those expectations are changing quickly. And, you know, we need to respond. 50 years ago, the average turnover on the S&P 500 was about 75 years. Today, it's about 10 years. Jeff Bezos even came out recently at a shareholder call and said, you know, I'm worried we might not even be in business in 2030, 2035.
Yeah.
because think about it. This is what I mean about the age of applied innovation and applied technology. Most things are not defensible. Most things can quickly and easily be copied. Unless you're dealing with deep developed science and deep technology, and those things will always be there, you're faced constantly with a need to constantly innovate, constantly reinvent yourself, and stay out in front of that technology adoption curve.
Yeah. For me, I mean, we talked in the last one about, and I've mentioned this before, my experience with photography in the early days of digital photography. And for me, the examples that you mentioned, like Uber and Airbnb and Amazon and Facebook, they've asked different questions. So they're kind of asking questions, you know, what is it that we actually do for people? So the hotel industry, for example, said, well, we own hotels and we rent out rooms or suites to our customers. And then, you know, there's a whole experience around that. Some of them provide a premium experience, others it's more value for money kind of thing. But it was all based on the premises that we have the assets that we rent out to people. But what they're actually really doing when you chunked it up one level was they were just providing accommodation for people. So Airbnb said, well, we can do that without owning assets. And similarly, Uber and then Amazon, like you said, they make us all happy. It's not, you don't think of, okay, they provide books because they do a lot more than that. In fact, I just recently bought something quite special from Amazon that is a bit of camera gear, and Amazon happened to have the only one available right now. So it's kind of a different mindset, isn't it?
Very much. In fact, there's a great story about Airbnb languished for the first few years. And what really accelerated their growth was the minute, and this kind of ties back to your background about images, the minute they started bringing in professional photographers to take professional images of the facilities is the moment they started to get real traction.
Hmm. Yeah, that's right. I love that story because it kind of comes back to a little bit the marketing background. Yeah, what is it that they're solving? What's the problem? And part of demonstrating that they're able to solve that was showing the visuals, the photographs of the properties that they had access to.
Yeah, and that was accidental. It's not like they said, this is going to change the world for us.
Hmm.
They saw conversions just exponentially grow once they started to do it, and they just kept doing more and more of that. But all they did was say, okay, we're going to take one slice of, we're going to take a long tail off of Craigslist, which is rooms for rent, and we're going to create a marketplace for that. It was slow going in the beginning until they started to throw the images up there. The visual, the brain, 60% of the brain power goes to the eyeballs.
Mm.
That's where you're going to capture people's attention.
Yeah. Yeah. That brings me back, or sort of triggers in my mind again, your second point in terms of the three things that an innovative company should be doing, and that's developing a functional learning organization. So tell us a little bit more about that, because I think that's a really good example of applying that mindset. They tried something else out. They learned that, hey, this is increased our conversions, and so they went all in with producing really good quality photos. And I think, you know, looking as a user of Airbnb from time to time, I'm certainly influenced by the quality of the photos they put up there. So it's not Airbnb doing the photographer, it's the property owner who puts the photos up. And often I think, well, that person should invest in a good photographer because they're not doing themselves justice.
Right. Well, so the first thing is that the three objectives of my approach, I didn't just pull those out of thin air or just come up with something that was kitschy, right? They came from 25 years of experience. And the second one, creating a functional learning organization, is a very practical response to the conventional wisdom of we have to transform cultures. And everything that I do is around acceleration, right? How can we get there faster, cheaper, and better than we have before? And most of it's behavioral. And so when you think about things through that lens, to use another photography analogy, when you think about things through that lens, what's most practical, whether you're in a large, especially in a large organization? There's the axiom, the old axiom of go, if you want to go fast, go alone. If you want to go far, go together. I agree with that. But going fast, but stage one is about going fast and going alone. So you get as small a team as you need, and you create functional learning. And that means operationalizing the feedback loops. So for example, that means you've got one person responsible for market development, you've got a team of people responsible for product development, and that market developer needs to functionally operate in a way that is constantly feeding the product team with feedback from the market so that they're building what people want, not what they think they need. And that's possible at small scale. That's why one of the things I like to say is do the things that don't scale to scale later. And it's a hard thing to teach large organizations because they're always thinking, especially at the stakeholder level, about scale, right? We want to work on the things that are going to that are going to be monetarily in the same range and ballpark of all the other things that we do. So if it's not $1 billion opportunity or a $500 million opportunity or a $100 million opportunity, we don't want to work on. Okay, that's fine. But that doesn't mean that you start building out an organization to support $100 million in revenue out of the gate. And how you, especially with digital products, which are very different than physical products, you don't have the same supply chain. You don't have the same, logistics. You don't have the same capacity issues, capacity models and constraint models. They are very different. How you take something to market, how you onboard it, how you implement it, how you support it is very different in digital products than it is in physical products, number one. Number two, the resources required to do that while you're still learning are very different than what they will be once you do achieve scale. But the problem I always see is they organize and structure for scale too soon, waste too much money, don't meet business model requirements, and then scrap it when they never had to do it that way. Had they done it in a very lean way, they might have been able to get there faster. So what I try to do is just organize for functional learning with a very small group of people that can support a statistically significant cohort of early customers and partners that we can learn with. And if that means we're going to take five existing relationships that have the right mindset and the right use case, and their timing meets ours, and they're willing to give us the time and truth we need to learn together to create mutually beneficial outcomes, then I'm going to structure an organization that can crush that. Only that, until we get to patterns. And then once you get to things that are repeatable, predictable, and scalable, now you can have that conversation about transition from the learning phase to the transition phase and then ultimately to an expansion phase. But I see way too often everybody's already sort of building out and thinking and operating as if this is going to happen. And that's very dangerous thinking when you're taking something someplace new. And that's one of the many reasons why 90% of corporate innovations fail and 80% of funded startups fail.
Yeah, there's a lot of merit in not investing big up front, doing lots of experiments, and you know, you've outlined a really great learning process. I like the idea of operationalizing the feedback loops and also having a kind of, I think you mentioned Tiger Team the last time we spoke, which is that small group, right? That's doing that's functionally set up to test those small scale things without a big investment up front, without thinking about scale at this early stage.
Very much so. It's not a shock and awe campaign. Right? It needs to be surgical, it needs to be focused, and it needs to have real measurable objectives. And those need to be transparent, and they need to be communicated to the customer as well as to your stakeholders in a way that shows that learning is progress, and that learning will lead to revenue. And that's the part where that's what I call sort of the Silicon Valley of death. That's where so many of these companies fall apart and fail, is they allocate resources at the wrong time in the wrong areas. And then eventually they run out of those resources, or they run out of stakeholder support. And then they, especially in corporates, right, they stop managing the innovation, and they start managing their careers, and they back into the bushes like Homer Simpson, and they pretend like it never happened, and they go back to their normal core competency and job. And I get that and understand it, but that's another big issue with corporates. They don't dedicate specific resources with the right stage relevant skills to this learning process. And as a result, so many of their things fail.
Now, last time we spoke, you also told me about a really good example applying kind of this learning mindset and the initial testing thing, the StageGate project that you talked about, and having big savings come out of that. So tell us a little bit more about that one again.
Yeah, I think everyone needs to rethink what their innovation process looks like. It needs to be more of a methodology than a process, number one. And to me, the difference between a process and a methodology is a methodology has a process plus an approach that's very much centered on learning. And so if you create an innovation process centered around a learning framework that's designed really to seek product market fit for an idea before that idea is fully formed and all the capital and resources are invested in building it as if it's already successful, and work your way back to the lab from there, you can reduce the time and cost to launch any innovation and improve the success rate. An example of that is we have a client that's one of the largest players in the auto industry that had an innovation process and budget and timeline that was about $2.1 million per innovation in about 2 years. And we were able to reduce it to, I think it was $900,000 in 7 months, simply by flipping the script and saying, before you start going down the path too far with this piece of intellectual property, let's identify some initial customers under these criteria that we can go have conversations with and partner with to do joint development. It doesn't necessarily mean you have to share the IP. That scares the shit out of people all the time. but what it does do is identify what are the key problems that your existing relationships have that you might be able to solve, and how do you prioritize what you work on based on that? And then how do you do it together in a way that allows you in an iterative sense to solve their problem in a meaningful way, knowing full well going into it that if you solve it for them, you can solve it for your other customers. Because that's typically the case. Very rarely are we solving a problem for one person that others do not have.
That's right. Yeah. Well, those savings are kind of pretty impressive and pretty startling on the one hand, but for me, not surprising, because I've been through exercises like this in the corporate world. And I had to laugh a little bit when you said the giving away the IP is scary. that's always the first thing people put up when you suggest, in the corporate world, in my experience anyway, when you suggest this kind of approach, talking to customers early on, talking to a small group, sharing information in that learning way. And then, one of the things that I always had held up back, oh no, we can't share that information. That's our own IP.
That's right. Yeah. And that's a traditional fixed mindset that gets companies disrupted. And there's really three kinds of innovations, right? There's core innovations. What can you do to continuously innovate on your existing business? What's adjacent to it? Like, what are the things you touch or exist within your ecosystem where you have the knowledge, skills, and expertise to enter those areas if you so choose, and the relationships to leverage to create those opportunities? And then, of course, there's the disruptive stuff, the things that you just don't see coming. And, my investment thesis for corporate venture is always, you need to invest in the things that would put you out of business. You don't want to be the next yellow cab in the age of Uber. And so how do you create that environment where people can harness disruption and then execute well to figure out what is useful and valuable in the market and what is not.
Yeah, and that's core to the whole philosophy, isn't it? That figuring out what's valuable in the market and what problem can I solve?
Absolutely. You know, as a venture fund, we host a lot of EIRs that are called entrepreneurs in residence, successful entrepreneurs we've invested in the past who need a place to sit and think and figure out what they want to work on next. And so you give them the resources to do that. And the most successful ones are very much focused on, they're not wedded to a particular idea as much as they're wedded to a formula to go out and figure out what the next big problem in the market that they can solve really well is. And they'll spend a lot of time having those conversations and doing early market development, talking to leaders in different businesses and trying to understand what their greatest challenges are. The beauty of innovation is that every new innovation creates a whole new set of challenges associated with it, which creates a whole new set of opportunities for everyone. Mm. I'm very much an optimist about what technology and innovation is doing. I'm not worried that it's going to take everyone's jobs. It's going to create new jobs, different kinds of jobs. People have to respond to that. But technology's proven that throughout history. The Industrial Revolution took away something like 90% of the farm jobs, but we don't have 90% of our farmers unemployed. There are other things that people move into. They went from farms to factories, and now they're going from factories to the service economy. And any and all of these repetitive tasks, low-value repetitive tasks, will become automated if they haven't already. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. That opens up opportunity for more creativity. You know, I see a future where everybody's job is a creative job. And they're thinking of new ideas and they're coming up with new and unique and interesting ways of solving the world's problems instead of doing repetitive tasks because the robots are doing it for us. Mm. That's a good future.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I agree with you on that. That's there's a show that I'm kind of half watching. I sort of get frustrated by it and leave midway through it. There's a series on our local television here at the moment looking at the future of work, and it's kind of framed in the pandemic environment. But they're talking about AI and how, you know, robotics is going to take over all these jobs and that people are going to have to figure out ways of doing it, and most people are going to end up unemployed, and most people graduating university now these days that don't have a future really, because, you know, they're being educated in something that isn't going to be needed in the future. And I thought, well, why not turn that around and say, well, let's start at the other end of that and say, well, where are the opportunities and how can we help people learn the skills that they need to take advantage of those opportunities, and how can we kind of highlight those opportunities and brainstorm as a community what that might look like, what those opportunities might look like. And I agree with you, you know, the ability to actually enhance the creativity of the entire community is just massive.
Well, I agree. And, you know, one of the talks I do a lot, because, you know, one of our businesses is GrowthX Academy, where we train people to work in technology companies in non-tech roles, in the creative roles, in sales, in business development, in digital marketing, in UX design, in data science. And so one of the things I talk a lot about are the skills necessary to be successful in the innovation economy. And these are skills that everyone at any stage in their life can adopt. Mm. And it starts with mindset. A growth mindset. Be a learn-it-all, not a know-it-all. Recognize that what you don't know is more important than what you do. Don't be afraid of failure. Remove the word rejection from your vocabulary. Replace it with feedback. View feedback as a gift. Develop EI in the age of AI. AI is never going to replace emotional intelligence and creativity. It's not going to happen. Mm. We know so little about the human brain. It's ignorant of us to say that we're going to replace the human brain with AI, when we still know so little about how the brain works, its complexities, how it evolves and grows. Replicating that is going to, we're 150, 200 years away from that. Not in the least. so how do you separate yourself in the age of AI? You separate yourself with EI, emotional intelligence. How do you create more human connections and use humanity and your own humanity and other people's humanity to create value for the world? business acumen, understanding how businesses work, how they make money, what incents them and drives them, and how you can contribute to that as an individual member of society is critical. That's the third skill. So understanding business models, understanding what a business does and for whom and how, and once again, how they make money and how you can contribute to that. Market acumen, the ability to quickly ramp up on a particular domain, area, expertise, become a subject matter expert, if you will. In today's market, everybody wants to talk to thought leaders and subject matter experts. So how can you master a particular area, one that's interesting to you and also challenges you? And then communication skills. How can you articulate that value that you could provide to, say, a business or to a community or a particular market? Not just verbally, but synchronously and asynchronously. Body language, tonality, using things like honesty and integrity and humility in your gait and your cadence. Writing well, being able to read well, being able to tell stories. Very, very critical. And then, yeah, you should learn another language and learn how to learn languages quickly. And when I mean languages, I don't just mean learning Chinese or learning Spanish, but also learning how to code, how to program those robots to do things for you. When you have that set of skills today, you can be a generalist and be very successful. A good friend of mine, the founder of AngelList, Naval Ravikant, one of the best followers on Twitter, at Naval, N-A-V-A-L, talks about specialization as for insects. and so, yes, you can create subject matter expertise in a given area, but you also need to have a well-rounded generalist view so that you can quickly adapt to the ever-changing environment in which you live. And that comes from being creative, having a unique point of view, and being able to articulate that, understand and learn things very quickly. And so if you can go about mastering those skills in your life, you're going to be valuable no matter what you want to do at any time and in any place.
Well, that little 5-minute presentation was worth the price of admission here alone. Thanks for that. And it would be a good contribution to this show.
Good. I hope so.
Yeah, I should get in touch with them and say, hey, you need to interview Sean Shepherd.
Well, the universities and the institutional education system is another real problem. You want to talk about a group of people that are resisting change. Until today, they've had very little reason to change. Their business model, their tuition structure, government-backed low-interest student loans allow them to jack up prices. Saddling people with debt, being activists instead of educators, viewing some of the most valuable roles in society, like sales, for example, as in a second class status when it's as important as anything in business and in society, and not teaching for it, not promoting it at a very young age, not introducing people to all these skills and opportunities earlier. And then leaving it to us to do all the training and education when they graduate. It's a real shame. If they're not careful, we're going to end up in a time, in a place where there's probably a handful of universities around the world that are going to actually matter and be successful. And those ones will be that way, not because of the quality of the education, but because of the access they provide to a network of opportunities through alumni. And all the rest of it can and should be learned on, in a very highly customized, self-paced approach that includes flip mastery, experiential learning. The fastest way to learn something is to experience it. And we don't do enough of that. And if those folks aren't careful, I know in the U.S., university admissions are down. It's not something they talk about. Why would they? But they're down. I'm seeing more and more, and I have one in university now and one is going to be going to university next year. And they're both wonderful students and they want to go to four-year universities because they want specific certifications that are science-based. But if they weren't, I would say, you don't have to go. I'm not going to force you. If you know what you want to do with your life, go do it.
Yeah.
Why spend 4 years and $250,000 of my money on an indoctrination camp?
Yeah.
And then you come out and you still have to learn a skill because those skills aren't being taught.
That's right. Well, the other thing I think, I mean, certainly my experience in my day, and this is going back a ways, was that, you know, I came out of university with an education and with some skills that I'd learned, but there are a couple of key things that I wish they'd taught me in those days. And I've kind of developed those skills in the meantime, and that's how to actually learn and project management. Project management is the big one. When I did my first project management course, I thought, why didn't they teach me this at school even? And, right. You know, that just made such a difference to me. And then, you know, like you mentioned, then there's things like sales or marketing, which is things that I've learned along the way through experience in my career that, you know, that I got onto. And even sales today, I'm probably not that skilled in sales because I don't practice it enough. And also because there's this deep-seated mindset from way back when that says, well, that's not something that has the same status. Now, luckily, both of my kids, they've completed their degrees now, and they actually sought opportunities to extend themselves and learn, and they were sort of versed in a whole lot of different things. And I think they've embraced this whole idea that it's not just the skills that they learned, but it's also learning how to learn and taking on new things, trying out new things.
Very much. The Feynman technique is my favorite model for learning how to learn quickly, which says, you know, you absorb a concept and then you try and teach it back. And then you look at the gaps and you fill in the gaps, because until you can teach it, you don't fully understand it. And I love that approach. It's something we use at the Academy as a way to accelerate people's learning, along with experiential and what we call the key takeaways, which I adopted from Greg McKeown's book, Essentialism. Try and take three key takeaways from every experience, every new experience. What are the top three things you learned from that experience? Write those down, have a conversation with yourself and others about those three things, and you'll absorb more from every new experience that way and be able to actually adopt it than any other technique that I've seen.
Great. Well, this is awesome, Sean. I could go on for ages, but I'm just watching the time here a little bit. And I think it's a good point now to move on to the Buzz, which is our innovation round. And it's designed to help our audience, who are primarily innovators and leaders in their field, with some tips from your experience. So I've got five questions, and hopefully you'll give us some really insightful answers that'll inspire the listener to go and do something awesome today as a result. So what do you think the number one thing is anyone needs to do to be more innovative?
I think they need to have a growth mindset. I think they need to be learn-it-alls instead of know-it-alls. I think they need to be open to any and all possibilities. And I think they need to be very much focused on their customer and their customer's problems as opposed to their own thing. I think it was Charles Koch said, if you don't know what's on your customer's fridge, then you really don't know your customer.
Yeah, I like that.
Spend more time focused on what's going on outside around you than what's going on inside. More innovative.
Great. Yeah, I love that. The idea of learn it all, I've come across that a bunch of times now with people I've spoken to on the podcast, and I really like that concept. It's certainly, I mean, we talk about know it all as it's almost a derogatory term, but I think the learn it all is a big compliment, if you say that of somebody. So good aspiration to have. Now, what's the best thing you've done to develop new ideas?
I collaborate. I don't think anybody, at least my mind and the way I work, I need to collaborate with others. And I need to be, because I have a growth mindset, I always feel safe about sharing the craziest, dumbest things in the world. I perceive to be the craziest and dumbest things in the world. But for me, I need collaboration, and I need visual stimulation. So a big whiteboard, a lot of pens and erasers, and a lot of conversation with other people who I know will tell me the truth.
Hmm. Yeah, I love it. And I love the idea of not being afraid to humiliate yourself. I think Alex Osterwalder said in our conversation on the podcast, he said, be prepared to humiliate yourself in answer to one of these questions.
I love it.
Hmm. All right. Now, do you have a favorite resource? You mentioned whiteboards. Is that your favorite resource?
My favorite resource are other people.
Yeah.
Whether that's existing relationships or learning from others. So, for example, now, I mean, I've stopped listening to the radio and for the most part watching television and absorb, take my free time and use it to read and listen to podcasts and hear thoughts and ideas from other people. I'm always in search of new ideas and new ways to think, and I'm very much focused on things that create personal development for me, because I believe there's no, in the innovation economy, there's no distinction between personal and professional development. If you develop yourself as a person, you'll develop yourself as a professional. So I'm always looking for different people's opinions and ideas on things that are really centered around human behavior. Philosophy, psychology, neuroscience. I've become, the older I get, the more I focus on people's actions instead of their words. And I've become a lifelong sort of student of human behavior. Because at the end of the day, every business model is H to H, human to human.
Yeah, that's right. I love it. And isn't it wonderful these days that we have access to so much direct knowledge that from people all around the world? We're not reliant on what's fed to us through the mainstream media.
That's right. And that's the beauty of the internet. Yes, it can be an ugly place too, but all that ugliness is just the amplification of human behavior. that the beauty is also the amplification of human behavior. And so we tend to find what we focus on. If we can focus on the things that are going to make us better, so that we can help others, I think that's the right way to approach life.
Hmm. Okay. Now, what's the best way to keep a project on track?
Oh, gosh. At least with me, I need to surround myself with people that are really good at that and hold me accountable. and that's just the honest truth. I think personally, you know, I'm always, you know, I'm very much a strategic thinker and a creative thinker. And I can set the wheels in motion, but I need to surround myself with others who will help execute on those things and make sure that I'm doing my part. So to me, it's about organizing the right, putting the right people in the right place.
Again, comes back to what you were saying earlier about collaboration.
Yeah. And behaviors. Again, it's people and markets that determine success, not products and tech.
Yep. Wonderful. And what's the number one thing anyone can do to differentiate themselves?
The exercise of identifying differentiation is a longer winded answer. But I think what you're really asking me is I think the way I'm going to answer it is that you need to have a unique point of view. Everyone comes to every situation with their own point of view, and that's a collection of knowledge and experience and environment. And can't be afraid to share your point of view, because your point of view is going to be unique in some way to the appropriate people.
Yeah, I love that. And also having the courage to share that point of view then, and being prepared to be humiliated, coming
Absolutely.
Back to another point.
Yeah, that's right. Don't be afraid. Society conditions us to fear the unknown and the worst possible outcome. And of course, negative self-talk is one of the most dangerous things anybody can do to themselves. And we can easily, in the absence of feedback from the outside world, jump to the most negative conclusions and then prevent ourselves from sharing that point of view.
Hmm. Yeah, I heard, I was looking at a list of questions for a suggested deeper networking thing. And one of the questions there was something along the lines of most of the conversations we have during the day are actually conversations we have with ourselves. And so what conversation are you having with yourself right now? So I think that's a good one to reflect on in terms of what are you telling yourself right now and what barriers are you putting up right now to do whatever it is that the idea that you might have.
Critical element of growth mindset is mindfulness, right? Catch yourself in the moment and stop and ask yourself what you're doing and why. A very good friend of mine and a mentor at the Academy is the Dean of Psychology at the University of California, San Francisco. And he talks about negative self-talk. And he would say to me, and this changed my life when he said this, he said, Sean, when you're down on yourself and hard on yourself and you're talking to yourself negatively, ask yourself, would you ever say those things to another person?
Hmm.
And of course, the answer is no. And I'm naturally a perfectionist. I'm very hard on myself. And I hold myself to a standard that's probably unfair. And I have to constantly work at that. And I think we all do to a certain degree. So don't beat yourself up and don't allow that to happen. I mean, there are biophysical reasons why that happens. There's this condition called leaping, where we leap, a section of our brain will leap to the negative outcome or conclusion because it's a fight or flight response. It's trying to protect us.
Yeah.
And it doesn't know the difference between what we're virtually thinking about that hasn't happened and what has actually happened. It cannot distinguish. So you create a scenario in your mind. Your brain thinks it's real.
Hmm.
And so that flight or fight, that lizard brain response will be to go to the worst possible outcome to help protect you from harming yourself. And so you have to recognize that and know the difference between truth and reality because your brain isn't going to do it.
That's right. Yeah. Yes, it's a wonderful thing, isn't it? And it's probably a topic for another whole series of podcasts.
Yeah.
Hmm. All right. Well, this has been absolutely fabulous, Sean. Now, where can people find out more about you and about GrowthX and maybe even get in touch and say thanks for what you've shared with us today?
Sure. They can connect with me on LinkedIn, follow me on Twitter at Sean A. Shepherd. They can go to growthx.com or gxacademy.com to learn about the other work that we do. But happy to field any conversations that come in from your audience.
Great. And we'll have links to those in the show notes as well. Now, what parting advice would you like to leave our listener today?
Well, I think there's a whole host of things, certainly, but the number one reason innovation fails is lack of proper execution. And I think you need to find a framework or a model that you can operate around that's going to help you find the truth about where your product fits in the market, create functional learning, and find scalable business models.
Mm, great. And certainly we've talked a lot about how that framework might look today, and you can find out more on GrowthX in terms of all the information that you share there. Finally then, who's someone else I need to have on the InnovaBuzz podcast and why?
Oh, goodness. Well, I think if you can get Naval Ravikant, that would be fantastic, the founder of AngelList. I think he's one of the true great thinkers of our time. His tweet storms on Twitter are prolific. And he's very much focused on mind, body, and spirit and how to think and behave in today's world.
Mm, great. Well, we'll see if we can jump into his Twitter feed and start a conversation with him. And
I had to spend a weekend with him in Colorado 2 weekends ago, and I swear in 2 days he gave me a lifetime of things to think about. It was
okay. Well, maybe we'll get an introduction from you.
Sure. I'll do my best.
Yeah. All right. Well, thanks so much for sharing your time and your insights with us so generously today on the InnovaBuzz podcast, Sean. I've really enjoyed this, learned a lot. There's been so much to think about here, so much to dig into more. I wish you all the best for the future, and let's stay in touch.
Yes, let's do that, Jürgen. Thank you so much.
I hope you enjoyed that insightful and informative conversation with Sean and took something away from his episode. Now, today's episode was so full of gold nuggets that it's actually hard for me to pick just one highlight, but I'll go with the overall theme of a growth mindset with a learn-it-all attitude. I'd love to know what you took away from Sean's episode. Leave a comment below the blog post, which can be found at innovabiz.co/Sean Shepherd. Hard to say. That's SEANSHEPPARD. All lowercase, all one word, innovabiz.co/Sean Shepherd. You'll also find more information about Sean there, as well as links to the GrowthX website, his social media pages, and the other resources we spoke about in our conversation today. Sean suggested we have a conversation with Naval Ravikant, founder of AngelList, on a future InnovaBuzz podcast episode. So Naval, keep an eye on your inbox for an invitation from us to the InnovaBuzz podcast, courtesy of Sean Shepherd. Tune in again to the next episodes of the InnovaBuzz podcast, where we've got even more fantastic guests lined up, including Karan Nijavan of Jube and Jamie J of Bottleneck Virtual Assistants. Thanks for listening to this episode. Make sure you subscribe to the show to be reminded of new episodes. It's free to subscribe. Leave a review if you like. Even if you don't like me, I'm okay with that. I'm asking you to leave a review because it helps other people find this show. Go to innovabiz.co to join our marketing transformation community and access a free gift my team and I made for you. It's the Marketing Master Mini Class. We want to give you everything you need to transform your marketing into a human-centered, relationship-focused growth engine. Until next time, I'm Jürgen Strauss from InnovaBiz. Remember, be awesome and keep innovating.